Fire rescue, EMS, law enforcement. These are the three components of public safety. And those who answer the call are the first responders. Welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force with your host, Steve Green. Five Alarm Task Force presents some of the best instructors, leaders, and mentors in public safety today to educate, elucidate, and entertain. No topic is out of bounds, and every opinion has value. Five Alarm Task Force is brought to you by Five Alarm Task Force Corp. One family, one mission. First responders helping each other. And our sponsors, Insight Fire Training, LLC. Your best bet for fire service thermal imaging camera training. The Firehouse Tribune, where you can expand your horizons in emergency services and learn to work hard, stay safe, and live inspired. And our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, LifeScan Wellness Center, saving the lives of America's heroes, Nestor Bars, the amazing new hand tool for the fire service, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, fighting to extinguish firefighter cancer since 2004, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, the Albemarle Sweet Shop, the North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. Remember, our ultimate goal is for you to be safe and return home after every call. So insert those earphones or turn up those speakers. The Five Alarm Task Force is being dispatched right now.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force. I'm your host, Steve Green. The podcast is brought to you by our company, Five Alarm Task Force Corp., a new nonprofit company that we'll be announcing a lot more within just a couple of weeks. We're happy to have you with us. If you are a new viewer and or listener, we always welcome new ones to our little group here, both on Zoom and on our podcast. If you're a returning listener, we're always welcoming you back to our show. I'm glad to have you with us, and thank you all on both sides for spreading the news about us on social media. We really do enjoy it. If you enjoy what you're watching or listening to today, you can go to our website for all the audios, which is at www.dalmatianproductions.tv. For now, it'll be changing soon, but you can still go there, choose the podcast tab on the top of the menu, and it'll take you to our library. If you want to watch the videos we have shot from Zoom interviewing our guests, you can go to our YouTube channel, also called Five Alarm Task Force Corp. Now, those are the most recent ones, and we had a previous channel. You can still see some episodes there. Just look for Five Alarm Task Force. That's it. So we have two channels there right now, but we'll always be adding to the new one under the corporation name, Five Alarm Task Force Corp. And we'd love to hear your comments on YouTube, so you can leave them there and tell us what you think of these episodes. My guest today is an amazing returning guest because of what he has done for the fire service. His name is Dr. Graham Peasley, and I'll tell you about him in just a few moments. While you're on our website, we hope you'll sign up for our newsletter on the homepage or on the About section of the website. And the website will be changing over the next couple of weeks. We're almost finished with the changeover for it. But if you go to our homepage, you can sign up for our newsletter. There is no cost for it. Just drop in your email. We send it out about 6-7 times. It might be 8 times this year because of the new announcements with the nonprofit, etc. But we don't give away your email. We don't sell your email. We protect it to the very best of our legal ability to do so. But if you ever want to unsubscribe, just send us an email to dalmatprod@outlook.com, and we'll be happy to take you off that list. Make sure you put unsubscribe in the subject, and you'll be deleted that very day without anything else. We hope you like us and follow us on Facebook. We're going to be closing down one of the pages, the Dalmatian Productions page on Facebook, and we'll just be on the Five Alarm Task Force page very soon. But we do love to see all the likes and all the messages that we get. I try my best. It's not easy to return those messages to you, but know that in our hearts, it means a great deal to us. And if you listen to the audio podcast on a podcast platform, most of those platforms actually request you to fill out a small ratings or comments. and we could sure use your help. Why? Well, it helps in two ways. Number one, it helps us that other people see that you like the show and that we're bringing interesting topics to the fold. And number two, those podcast platforms use those reviews as part of the algorithm on when people search for us, how far or up or down are we in the search results? So the more positive reviews we have, the higher we're up on the search algorithm, the lower we are. Well, the lower we are on the search algorithm. So we need you to help us with some great comments and 4 or 5 stars on the various podcast platforms that you may listen to us to. And that's really it. Let me tell you about our guest, Dr. Graham Peasley. He was trained as a nuclear chemist and has worked in fundamental research for more than 30 years with over 200 peer-reviewed publications, most with student co-authors, as he loves to combine research with student education. Over the last 5 years, his research program has shifted to applications of nuclear science, where he has developed accelerator-based techniques that can rapidly measure materials for particular chemicals, such as per- and polyfluorinated alkyl substances, what we call PFAS for short, on solid surfaces. The technique he developed is the first spectroscopic measurement of fluorine that can be done in minutes, quantitatively and non-destructively. And it has changed the way we can survey lots of materials for the presence of PFAS rapidly and reliably, such as food packaging materials and textiles. Never a firefighter himself, he does have relatives in the fire services. Chief Paul Peasley of Hingham, Massachusetts Fire Department, was a distant cousin. And you will be surprised, especially if you're in the fire service, with the results of his tests. When he was with us about a year ago, he was unable to actually announce results because it had not been published yet. But in today's episode, he shares those with us. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with Dr. Graham Peasley right after these words. Please don't go away. New technology for the fire service seems to appear almost every day, and that technology demands a learning curve, especially if we're talking about thermal imaging cameras. That's where Insight Fire Training LLC is your best bet. With an excellent reputation across the U.S., Insight Fire Training will meet all your TIC training needs. Their curriculum is peer-reviewed and has been used internationally. Their instructors are Level 1 thermography certified, and they have taught in 33 states and 4 countries. Their courses run from introductory to training the trainers. Courses are available online, for the classroom, classroom hybrid, and even live fire. Insight Training LLC is proficient in over 40 thermal imaging cameras, so you feel confident they will know your make and model. Best of all, programs are customized to your specific needs, and their cadre of fire service veterans are vetted craftsmen of Project Kill the Flashover. They are so proficient that they have trained TIC manufacturers on how to best use and sell their own product. That's Insight Fire Training LLC. Look them up on InsightTrainingLLC.com. Your best bet for TIC training. Would you like to meet up with Annie and the gang from Insight Training? Well, here's some of their upcoming schedule. Tactical Thermal Imaging Burn and Learn Training, hosted by the Township of Upper Providence, Department of Fire and Emergency Services in Pennsylvania. Insight Training will offer 2 days of classroom hybrid training with the Max Firebox. Day one will consist of classroom and Max Firebox demonstrations covering an overview of the curriculum. Day two will be a custom presentation titled Purchasing Implementation Criteria, where the department will receive a presentation on 3 thermal imaging cameras of their choosing and then test those devices through specific objectives with Max Firebox. This event will be held October 1st and 2nd. Tactical Thermal Imaging Train the Trainer in Harrisonburg Fire Department, Virginia. Insight Training will offer 4 days of customized training to the department. Days 1 to 3 will be operations in service for their firefighters. On day 4, Insight Training will offer a customized live fire presentation for the training cadre. This event will be held October 27th through the 30th. Also coming up, classroom hybrid 8-hour tactical thermal imaging training at Roxbury Volunteer Fire Department in New Jersey. Insight Training will offer an 8-hour day of classroom and live fire demonstrations on November 7th. Faith, Family, and Fire Conference, November 14th to 15th. Instructors Howard Reinwalt of FD Tactics, Kurt Isaacson of County Fire Tactics, and Andy Starnes of Insight Training will offer 2 days of conference-setting presentations on faith, family, and the fire service. This event is sponsored by the FD Tactics and will be in Maine. See our website for details as the venue is to be determined. And live fire tactical thermal imaging training, Harrisburg Fire Department in North Carolina. Insight Training will offer 3 days of classroom and live fire training for the entire department. This event will be held on November 18th, 19th, and 20th. Remember, Insight Training LLC, your best bet for tick training. The Firehouse Tribune, where inspiration was forged by those who came before us, opening the doors for us to build a path. A path to share our mission with the rest of the emergency service world. With a small, tight-knit team of first responders dedicated to sharing experiences and knowledge, we constantly strive to provide our followers with thought-provoking content from all aspects of emergency services and life. Our contributors speak at top fire and EMS conferences in the country. They have been guests on numerous fire service podcasts and will even come and speak at your firehouse or event. Interested? Visit their website, www.thefirehousetribune.com. And find them on Facebook using the Firehouse Tribune and on Twitter at FH Tribune and on Instagram, FH Tribune. We live by one motto, not just in emergency services, but in life as well. Excellence is a habit, not a goal. We look forward to hearing from you soon. Until next time, work hard, stay safe, and live inspired.
Welcome to Chief Miller. Chief Miller operates the largest social media page dedicated to the men and women of the fire service from around the world. Check him out on Instagram at Chief_Miller. Find him on Twitter at Chief_Miller. And check out the website where you can find Chief Miller Apparel at ChiefMillerApparel.com.
And welcome back to this episode of Five Alarm Task Force. I am honored and very pleased to bring you our guest today, who has been with us before a little over a year ago. And it's Dr. Graham Peasley. As we've said in previous podcasts, and if you're following the whole concept of the Firefighter Cancer Initiative, Dr. Peasley had really dedicated himself to testing our gear to find out, is there carcinogenic compounds, whether they're singular and they're carcinogenic or they combine due to heat and moisture, whatever, in our gear. In the next month or so, we'll also be featuring as a guest Mr. Robert Ballot, an attorney who has filed a asking for a class action lawsuit against this, dating back, and this is what surprised me, Dr. Peasley, dating back to 1977. That's the year I started in the fire service. So I printed out that top page with the parts per trillion in the blood, and I am taking that to my oncologist to have my blood tested. Even though I had a full bone marrow assay done a year and a half ago, this I think is different, and I think it warrants me going. So welcome back to the show. It's an honor to have you with us once again.
Thank you, Steve. This is an honor to be here. It's nice to revisit when I could not say everything before, and now I can say, well, it's published, and we get to be able to sort of fill in your listeners as to what actually was published and what does that mean. And things are happening very rapidly in the fire services now, which is very good to see. Generally, it's in the right direction. And I think that we can take credit to you and your listeners for, you know, having actually listened and said, why do we need this material to be so fluorinated? And the answer is, in my belief, that these materials don't need to be heavily fluorinated. There are alternatives that will keep the firefighters dry. And that's the primary purpose of these things, these chemicals being in the turnout gear. So let me, if you'll allow me, I'll just summarize for a couple minutes what our findings were. And it may be a rerun of what you heard earlier, but it's to the extent that we can say everything now. Our charge was to see, did all gear have fluorinated compounds in it, and does it come off? The third one is, does it get into the firefighter? And that's still an ongoing study, and we're trying to do dermal absorption studies right now to demonstrate that. But we already know that every piece of gear we looked at is fluorinated. And you can sort of shake your head and say, well, I knew that. It meets NFPA standards, and if NFPA standards say it's got to be this much durable world resistance. Everybody put the best stuff they had in it. Right. And that's where the PFAS were used. They were used to keep the gear dry because you don't want to add water weight to the gear. And then secondly, does it come off? And we kind of knew even when we last spoke that that's what we were going to see. And oh yeah, it comes off. And it comes off in many different ways. But there are three sets of garments we looked at, and we didn't excluded hoodies and gloves and belts because those are accessories. We were really looking at the turnout gear, the jackets and the pants. And we found that all the manufacturers, we tested several different types, a dozen different manufacturer brands, not quite, but at least six. And we found that they were all manufactured the same way. They all met NFPA 1971 and they all use the same textile mills. So yeah, it's all been fluorinated. There's an outer shell, which is fluorinated with a side chain fluoropolymer typically. And that's what gives it its durable water resistance. And then there's an inner layer, which is a moisture barrier. And that's usually a Teflon layer because it's required to be effectively. And both of those are fluoropolymers. Both of those are a type of PFAS. And in the old days, the moisture barrier, for example, were made in a bath full of PFOA, and some of it came along for the ride. They, since 2012, well, by the time you got the year 2014, they stopped using that. And we did observe that the PFOA went down in the moisture barriers after 2014. But there's still a lot of guys wearing the old gear or have worn the old gear. Sure. Not calling you old Steve or anything like that, but just that there were anybody alive before 2014? Yep. In fact, like, good part of that gear is still in service, right? It takes 10 years to phase out in general. Sure. So we do have the...
That's for the fire companies that can afford to change it after 10 years. We know.
And we won't even talk about where it goes when you get rid of your fire gear. Does it go to the fire academies where the young guys get it again? Or does it go to Mexico? Exactly. All of which I'm not sure I want to do. But then you have the moisture barrier that had PFOA in it. It's now swapped to not PFOA, but they've put in... let me put this delicately, a lot more PFBS, which is a C4. And so it's floated in a different polymer, a solvent, than the original one. And they did get rid of PFOA, which is true, but it's now got 100 times to 1,000 times more of the short chain material. And everybody will tell you, the argument is that, well, that's perfectly safe. It comes out of your body in 3 weeks. Whereas the PF... OA takes 3.7 years or four years for PFHXAS and 2.8 for PFOA. So it's 2, 3, 4, 5 years of half-life in the bloodstream. So if you were exposed to AFFF that had PFOS in it, you would have 3.8 years till that dosage went away. My argument is that because it spends only weeks in the body, which it's true, it does spend a lot less time in the body, it's excreted much more quickly. So if you get exposed to this, it will go away more quickly. But what if it's not an AFFF exposure, which is where most of PFAS is assumed to come from, and it may actually be the fire service's biggest deal is the PFAS coming from AFFF. That's still a dangerous substance out there, people using the extruders and getting covered with it. That's an exposure risk. And people are now switching away, thanks to the National Defense Authorization Act. The U.S. government is going to switch away from AFFF by 2024, which just is great because that's a huge stockpile we're getting rid of. But the question is, if you're exposed daily to a small amount coming off a turnout gear, could that have a different impact on your bloodstream than being a once a year or once every other year type of exposure to an AFFF event where you were covered in? And the answer may be that there may be, it's not zero. There's a risk. And we don't know what that risk is. PFBA is perfectly safe. Some people say, other people say, I've never met a fluorochemical that I really want in my body. And that's a precautionary risk. That's a precautionary approach and say, you know, we've not studied this. We don't know what the mice will do long-term. At the sort of chronic dosages, we know that a single dose is not as dangerous. Yeah, but this isn't a single dose. You've been wearing this gear for every day for a long time. And so that's the issue I have with the moisture barrier. The outer layer is a different type of error, and that's where it still has PFOA. Not that it's made with it, and so they can very cleverly say they never made it with PFOA. It's been made with a long chain fluoropolymer, which will then decay over time to release PFOA and other PFAS, the short chains as well, that will all shed off the material. And this is the same sort of principle that Scotch guarding was on carpets. And we knew that in the sunlight that the Scotch guard would wear off, your waterproofing wore off the carpets. And we talked about that. We thought that the gear might do the same thing. We didn't do an exposure study on the gear. That's more work. We just looked at old gear versus new gear. And we said, what does it look like? And we saw a significant fraction of the flooring come off. Over 10 years we'd see 15-20% of this stuff come off, and that was a significant fraction of the fluorine on the surface layer. That's not the entire jacket is falling apart. The amount of durable water resistance lost in 10 years is very little, like 3%, but that means the total fluorine has gone down a little bit of the whole jacket. But on the surface layer, we could see pretty dramatic effects, far bigger than that.
Let me ask you this question. Probably the biggest thing, I think we may have talked about that in our previous meeting, is that this bunker gear, and again, the AFFF, and in my department in North Carolina, we had a lot of AFFF because we were in a community where just outside the airport was part of our fire district, and we had the largest finished product gasoline tank farm in the country. And so our chief was very big on flammable liquids. He was an expert on it. He got Colonial Pipeline, a few of the others, to put in subsurface applicators, which was state of the art back in the 70s and early 80s. Mm-hmm. And then because of his work, we had, many, many 5-gallon pails of AFFF. But we only used it in my 4 years there, I can think of 3 times.
Yep.
And that includes a practice. Mm-hmm. But our gear, we wore every day almost for a lot of them were rescue calls, but a lot of them were fire calls. Yep. So my question is, even though the rate of the trail off of the P4 on the outer garment, is that amount that it releases affected by heat and moisture and high moisture, high hot moisture content?
Probably not as dramatically as just plain age and sunlight. Sunlight will actually cause the most damage with UV light, to the extent that it gets exposed to sunlight. But you need water as well. So, but guess what? You guys do have a lot of water, and you often get wet. And so that means that sunlight and water would be probably the most rapid aging. I'm not an expert on what the high heat will do to the textiles. My guess is that they'll weather pretty well because they're designed that way. But I don't have evidence to say that the more use, the more it came off. So the Metropolitan Fire District gear that we looked at was well used. It was often, it was taken out of service after 10 years because it had holes in it and it was starting to look pretty worn. And so those did have more fluorine loss, but I can't tell you that's because it was used in hot, high environments and stuff like that. It would make some sense that it would, but I think that there's just a natural shedding of this from sunlight, even without any use. So the first one we looked at was, in fact, just on a mannequin for 10 years, never used in service. It was a turnout gear. Wow. And they were afraid it had all worn off by then. Oh, no, there was plenty left on it. But I don't have enough studies to say that active use, but you can imagine that, like your carpets, the more wear you get, the more it comes off.
Sure.
What we found surprisingly during the study is that we found hand to garment contact transmission. So the students were, the very first time they got it, they put the coat on to see what it would look like. And everybody wants to be a fireman. My lab's no exception. And then the student very wisely measured his gloves before and after handling it. He says, I can see a difference. I can see fluorine on the gloves. And that was surprising because just by handling the gear, and he was roughly handling the gear out of the box and putting it back in the box or on the shelf and maneuvering the gear around. If he took a fresh pair of gloves, there was no fluorine. If he handled the gear for a minute and then took the glove off and put it in the beam, we could see that there was, 20 parts per million fluorine on it, which is measurable. It's easy to see. And so the gloves have none, do this. And we were able to test other textiles and it doesn't come off like that. I mean, it doesn't mean that the coats are shedding. Clearly the coats work for 10 years or more. There's a lot of material there. It's just the atomic layers come off and you see that on your glove. And that presents a risk because, nobody I know in the services until COVID hit, nobody was wearing the nitrile gloves and they, except on medical calls. And so we're not telling people that they should handle their gear with gloves. What we're telling them is that, you know, we're washing our hands is a good idea for COVID. Washing our hands when wearing a textile that's treated with toxins is a good idea as well.
You know, I was just going to say that because even on rescue calls and even today, I mean, I watch a lot of the videos and the alarm comes in and everybody goes to whether to the, if they hung their gear on the apparatus or it's mm-hmm. on a stand, they go with their hands, pull on the bunker pants, then Absolutely. Grab the cat. Everything is with the bare hands. Then if they know that they're being dispatched on a rescue call, then they'll put their nitrile gloves on. Mm-hmm. And when they take the gear off, when the time they get back, those gloves are off and yep. they handle it again with their bare hands. So they have all this exposure.
Exactly. And so there's a small but consistent exposure to the MAPRIC itself. Don't forget there's also combustion products. So if you're taking the gear off without gloves, then you've got whatever was on there. Or if there was an AFFF event where AFFF was sprayed on the gear, right. your gear catches most of it. But then that gear we found is really highly fluorinated. It has AFFF residue on it because that stuff never comes out. And so you could get transfer for anything to the hands. And it's just going to be a fact of life. We're going to wash our hands more now that we know that there's not just viruses, but other things that could, you know, combustion products and sure. unfortunately this PFAS on the gear. So we measured what it was and that it came off and that was present in everything we looked at, and even PFOA was still there because some of the gear is not new enough to have that, and the outside layer was still shedding plenty of it. not huge amounts. Some people say, oh, it's only part per billions. What are you worried about? Well, I'm worried about part per billions because that if you ingest that, that will be a source of PFAS in your bloodstream. And it's very hard to make material that doesn't have that as long as you're using it in the manufacturing process. And so the question that the paper asks is not that this is alarming, and we're very careful to say you should wear your gear because that's what's keeping you safe in a fire. Well, everybody should wear turnout gear, and don't get me wrong. And I'm not going to try and prescribe policies to whether you should wear gloves or whether you should wear the gear on a non-fire call. Those are all department policies that the departments in different districts will respond differently to. But no matter what, you can keep yourself safer just by precautionary. Use the gear when you need to and handle it with respect when you don't, and keep it separate from your living quarters. You should wash it in the extruders, not at home. You shouldn't keep it in the trunk. You shouldn't let the kids play on it. They shouldn't.
Yeah.
That type of stuff shouldn't be done with turnout gear. And simply because it's a functional occupational material that has got some toxins in it that keep you safe. Don't eat your turnout gear, but that doesn't need to be said, right? And so what I'm asking is the hard question, and this is the one the manufacturers have to answer, is that why does it need to be so fluorinated? It's there to keep you dry. Couldn't we use some of the other technologies to keep you dry? And there are dozens that will keep you dry. And not as good as this. This is the best. But, you know, if it keeps you dry under a full hose spray, isn't silicone good enough, or isn't microfibering good enough, or isn't some of these other things they have good enough? And and for water resistance, there's other materials that will pass NFPA 1971. Oil resistance, a little less so, but it isn't really oil you're trying to keep yourself from. Most situations, your situation, and if you're in a flammable refinery, yeah, you may want to do more oil resistance there. But for most municipal fire departments or the volunteer fires and things like that, they're not going to see oil spraying that to keep the coat dry. It's going to be water. And mm-hmm. water resistance can be met by other methods. And sure enough, we've seen the industry, several textile manufacturers, two of them now, have claimed that, well, we can make a fluorine-free water reducing that'll keep the outer shell from using any fluorine. And as long as that's available, you have the customer, i.e. the fire services, ask, well, would you like this to be really dry and have toxic chemical, or do you want it to be really dry and not toxic chemical? And that's your choice. And that, I think, is a pretty obvious question. Well, if I don't need it there, then why don't we make it that way? And that's my argument. Nobody likes change, so there will be some resistance. It will cost money, and the real cost is, what do you do with the 1.2 million times two sets of turnout gear that are on the shelf somewhere? Where is that going to go but into our drinking water? Because all of it's going to go in landfill eventually, and all of it will eventually come out of that landfill into our drinking water.
Let me ask you this. Would it be safe for that equipment to be incinerated, or does that release toxins into the air that could be detrimental to our health?
That's a very good question, Steve. And the answer is that tossing it in the landfill is probably the worst solution because it will come off. A high temperature incineration will destroy this chemical. And that's what, you know, you get above 800, 900 degrees, and this chemical breaks down to an inorganic form of fluoride, and that's safe. You don't want to breathe it as it comes out the smokestack at 900 degrees, but if it's done in a high temperature incineration, but the U.S. doesn't have many incinerators. Europe does incineration because it's a small land area, right? The U.S. doesn't have some. We have hazardous waste incinerators, and there are some protests around them because maybe they, when they first start up, they're not at high temperature, and some of the chemicals come out might be bad. The Navy is trying to burn up all its nerve gas, right? And so they also do high temperature incineration, but they do it out on the Marshall Islands somewhere. So there aren't, so, you know, the locals don't like it much, but nobody else cares. And so I think that same problem exists with incineration in this country. There's a lot of, I don't want it in my backyard, but sure, we should incinerate it. And the answer is that a new modern incinerator with high temperatures will get rid of this, even on textile, no problem. But that there's a cost to get it there. It's now hazardous waste. Just as we have, and I'll extend just for a moment, you mentioned earlier AFFF.
Right.
Not only does your department there have a lot of AFFF, but every municipal fire department in the United States has a store of AFFF somewhere. Right. And it can be, you know, my local emergency management has 450 gallons of it sitting downtown just in case they need it for an emergency, mm-hmm. In a shed. And, you know, what if we have that every couple miles for every firehouse in the station, you know, 57,000 of them, that's a lot of AFFF sitting around. And that's all got to be gotten rid of as well. And we don't want it to go down the drain or be put out on pallet fires. We want to make sure that it's properly disposed of, but that's now an expense.
How do we dispose of the old style AFFF?
Yeah. And that's where we need some government help because you need to buy that stuff back so it doesn't get used accidentally. You're going to need to dispose of it in a, Michigan has gone with a lined landfill, a hazardous waste landfill. I know that Oregon has got an incinerator and the guys at Madison, Wisconsin sent their old tanks out to, they just paid the cost to ship it to Oregon and burn it. And so I think that there's a cost in that. The answer in Wisconsin, they actually passed a legislature to buy back the unused foam because they didn't want it to go into landfill. Every time Wisconsin passed a law this year that says anytime any use of it, Class B foam is a hazmat incident. So that's a lot of paperwork, and the chiefs have effectively stopped using Class B foams in Wisconsin as a result.
We're also trying to, because of the Cancer Initiative,
yep.
We're trying to educate the fire service that basically you need to treat any fire call, whether it's a wastebasket or a dumpster, or an apartment with the shag carpeting as a hazmat call. And that's why we're trying to emphasize the decon on scene.
Yeah.
You know, before you even get back on the gear and go back to the station.
And let's not lose sight of the fact that combustion products are real carcinogens and you have to worry about that. And so the fire service is aware of that. They've got the self-contained breathing apparatus. They've got the decon procedures and all that sort of stuff that's well-developed. This is just one that's hitting them from the back. Nobody saw this one coming. And I'm not sure it's as dangerous as combustion products. Combustion products strike me as being very dangerous, but it's a risk and you minimize the risk. Same thing with this. This may or may not be comparable to AFFF. It may be much less. Maybe AFFF uses the primary exposure. But PFAS, you don't want to get exposed to anyway. It knocks down your immune system. That's bad. There are some diseases directly correlated to PFOA. All the rest are still waiting studies. And in 10 or 20 years, I'll give you a longer list of things that we know are exposed that will happen. But why wait? I mean, the firefighters now, we're working for the next generation to be safer.
Exactly.
Why don't we design the gear to be a little safer? Why don't we take the gear we have currently and just treat it with respect? The end of life is a big issue. How do I get rid of the gear? And I don't really want to, you know, if I am paralyzed with fear, I'll never get anything done. I'm not going to worry about end of life at this point. I'd prefer it off the firefighter and in the landfill at this point. We'll deal with landfills as they come, but eventually we'd like to not have the gear so we don't have that issue of end of life.
Well, I think that perhaps with all this information out there now, and it is spreading, thank goodness, more and more people are learning about it, that the Cancer Initiative really was genuine from two sides. We knew from our combustion products, that's what we first aimed for.
Yeah.
And learning there. And then came this discovery about the gear. But I think, as you said, you know, change comes slowly. The two things that the fire service detests the most are change and status quo. So, but I think that working together through the NFPA, the IAFC, the IAFF, and the NVFC. I think that we are dedicated enough to protect the lives of our firefighters and smart enough that we could arrange as an industry a way of having that a process for getting rid of end-of-life gear properly, getting rid of our AFFs, so that not each 50 of the 57,000 departments have to think, well, what are we going to do alone by ourselves? You know, we're out here in downtown Bumbledoggle, and there are 20, we have 2,800 people in the community, but we got AFFF because we know a rail car comes through here or tankers come through here to bring gasoline to the gas station. So we have to be able to protect it. I think we can't leave them out on the dock by themselves. I think that as a greater organization, the professionals, the fraternals can come together because it affects every one of us.
Exactly.
Whether you're seated as an officer on a board, you are still a firefighter.
Absolutely. And you couldn't have said it better, Steve. And this is a community issue. And it doesn't matter whether you're red or blue. This is a great election year, right? PFAS is going to get into you either way. And it's just whether you acknowledge what the sources are and how to minimize them. And we've already got them in all our blood. That's what Rob Lott will tell you about. And he's taking a very unusual approach of suing on behalf of every North American, which is really quite adventurous. So he's a hero of mine. But I think that the firefighters themselves are the local heroes, and they're not intentionally trying to pollute their environment. They live in their own community, right? They don't want to pollute their own water supplies. So now we understand that AFFF shouldn't go down the drain. And we didn't know that before because somebody told us it was safe with soap, and that's not true. It isn't. It is a toxin. It's just, it does it in a really different way than many other toxins. And so we want to minimize it in our gear. I would love the community to get behind, and it's already happening. And I was really amazed by this, but I'll call out Sean at the Nantucket Fire Department, 25 firefighters, right? Not the largest department in the world. It's on an island. It's a nice island in the summer.
In the state that we share, Massachusetts.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but nobody's ever heard of it. But I've been there. I've been to Nantucket once. It's one of those things that they asked the question of, why can't I get gear without this? And the power of that, one person asking was suddenly, now other people are asking, well, if they're getting safe gear, and the company that's making the first batch has pledged not to increase the price for the safe gear because it actually costs less to make, right? There's less fluorochemicals on it.
Sure.
And so they decide to sell at the same price. And I think that other companies will follow suit very quickly. There's already rumors that several of them have, and they're just trying to get this. It's just
business.
Yeah. And it's market demand. I'm not interested in any of these companies being hurt financially. It's the pandemic's worse enough, right? But I want them all to say, look, there was no, the company that sold the chemical told you it was safe. That's their bad.
Right.
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice. These guys are selling you the whole ball of wax.
Right.
Don't take what the chemical company tells you is safe until you have some independent evidence of that. This can be made without it. The bunker gear can be made without fluorochemicals, and it will work. The Europeans have already done it. The NFPA can certify that it's dry. We don't have a replacement for Teflon and the moisture barrier yet, but that's still, you got rid of half of it. The moisture barrier is a different type of PFAS, and in the polymer part of it is safe, certainly. But the fact that the polymer comes with all these other little particles inside it is what worries me, and that does come off with time. And so the question is, can we do that without doing it? And I'm told the test that prevents that from being taken out of the NFPA standard at the moment is a xenon lamp test. It's where you test for UV exposure. And Teflon is remarkably resistant to ultraviolet. It doesn't break down easily, whereas most other plastic layers, the polyurethane liners you used to have, broke down on this Teflon lamp. Of course, you're testing the inner liner for UV exposure. You think about that for a moment, you realize, right. Why are we doing this test? Do firefighters glow naturally in the dark? I didn't know that, but I'm in the nuclear business. We do that all the time, but it's the firefighters don't seem to be giving off a lot of UV light. It's an inner liner of your coat. It doesn't see the sunlight. Why are you worried about UV breakdown of this material? It seems to me to be an extraneous rule, but I'm not a textile expert, so maybe there's another reason it's there. But that one lamp test, if it were reevaluated by NFPA, might allow other materials besides Teflon to be used in the moisture barrier. And that would be a thing that I'm not going to call for because I'm no expert. I'm not a textile expert, but I think that the people will start looking at what alternatives there exist and what are the rules and policies made and who made them. And could these be worked around such that there's a way going forward, which protects both the firefighter first and foremost, but also the environment afterwards. And I think both of those for the communities we serve, yeah, we could put the fire out with asbestos too, but we don't. And there's a good reason for we don't do that, because A, it's occupationally hazardous, and B, there would be a lifelong result afterwards. Mm-hmm. And the fire services don't want that. They want to be on the good side of the story and not the brunt end of, absolutely, I've got a lake polluted because you put a fire out. And those are not the stories you want to read. And so we're learning that with AFFF. I'm just extending it to gear, and if the gear is made that it's waterproof but not with PFAS, it strikes me that it's a pretty good compromise. I think the departments should make their own decisions about when to wear and not wear, and where they should wash their hands, and all those sort of details. The local department told me that they respond to calls. If it's not a fire call, they'll respond with the gear in the truck, but they had never cleaned out the bin in the base of the truck. And I was like, oh, there's a 3 inches of dust in there. And I said, I can see some rookie being assigned to vacuum that out once a month, because that's probably a good place to get rid of that dust. And there's always hand to mouth contamination. Yeah, we try to wash our hands before we eat, but you know that from the combustion product analysis. If you're at a fire scene and you've been on it for 12 hours, you need to eat and rehydrate. But do you wash your hands before you do that every time? You should, but there's practicalities involved. And so we want to minimize what we can do in terms of exposure risk. And that's going to apply for these as well.
We could put that part into, since we're making now such a much bigger effort with rehab on scene, so that after firefighters been in a couple of times, a couple of tanks, we want them out, we want to do their vitals, we want to check them. And they're the ones who usually give them the water and a snack. So what we can do is with a little bit of effort, we can ask them to incorporate a sanitizer or washing ability before you hand them the water bottle or you hand them the snack, give them some hand sanitizer.
Yep. And I'm not an expert in exposure, so we should ask people to be, what's the easiest you can do with the least inconvenience? And, you know, it's different with COVID and what you have to wash your hands with. It's different with a fire exposure and combustion products, and it's going to be different with PFAS. All three are potential exposures, but if you have it on your hands and you go through normal business without washing it off, I know that's a source of exposure. And I don't know how big it is, and the relative risks, we don't know. But that's what NIOSH and company will study. They're very good at this, and they'll commission a 3-year study and do it. And they'll have much stronger evidence as to what fraction of this could be. And I'm hoping that we get one of Rob Ballot's outcomes is that we do blood testing for all firefighters. That would be remarkable. Yeah, just though it's very expensive and very hard to find people that will do it robustly. We're working on a test to try and speed that up, actually. But at the moment, it's $800 a test, and no insurance company is going to pay you that unless there's a medical need. And so, if you're not currently sick, how do you screen for it, and things like that? You know, all these same questions we're asking.
That's very interesting, because the oncologist I went to when I had my first scare, which was due to a misread of an MRI that I had done. Mm-hmm. And I have a medicinal pump implanted in me, and the port is up around T10 on the left side. Okay. So my pain management doctor, because I was having more pain, he said, let's do an MRI. We haven't had one in a couple of years. So I did it, and the radiologist reads it. I read the report the day after. He says, oh, there's an anomaly at T10. You cannot rule out multiple myeloma. I said, what? I said, that's my port. So I sent them the information, my primary and my pain. And they said, no, your port's there. It can't be. But he says, but we've got to check it out. We can't just disregard it. So I went through 6 weeks of testing where I didn't meet him. I had already met this oncologist through my late friend who went to him and asked me to come to most of their appointments because I could kind of translate what the oncologist was saying. And he and I hit it off. So he was the one I turned to when I, to get this testing done. And he didn't know anything about the Firefighter Cancer Initiative at that time. He didn't realize the exposure. He was under the same belief that I was back all the way in 2014, 15, that the firefighters we were hearing about with cancer had worked the pile after 9/11. And we knew that the exposure was terrible there in breathing and everything else and the combustion stuff. So that's what we thought. But I was dead wrong. I mean, literally dead wrong with that. And so when I told him about it, he asked for more information. Well, it was 2.5 years before I got to see him again because my hemoglobin was low. So my primary said, you need to go get tested again. So I went to him and he is full into the Firefighter Cancer Initiative now.
That's good.
Every source. He's been amazing with it. He said this, and that's why he said, I want to do, he goes, you know what? You've had all the other tests that show negative, but I really need to do the bone marrow assay to verify. And we're going to do it here. I'm going to do a medical one. I'm going to do the genealogical one because you do have cancer in the family. I said, okay, whatever you need to do. And we did it. It wasn't as bad. Hmm. And I made a deal with him. I just got him to only give me one of the local agents because that one doesn't cause any stinging as opposed to adding the other one in there. So we had a deal and we did it. And he did it. It was fine. And I went back 2 weeks later and he said, you're clear. 100% cool. Clear. There's nothing. So that was a year and a half ago. But yet when I heard these results and I read part of the report and read some of the other stuff that our dear mutual friend, Diane Cotter, who was really one of the great spearheads of this entire movement. I mean, she probably, if she was a firefighter, she'd be firefighter of the decade because her efforts will save so many firefighter lives, hers and all of us who joined that bandwagon. And we had to, there was no way you could say no to her. I think that hopefully we can get more oncologists themselves involved in this study. I'm going to reach out to my friends down at University of Miami, Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center, Dr. Martinez and Dr. Schaefer, and find out if there's a way to, you know, do these tests perhaps at an easier level that wouldn't cost as much, et cetera, so that insurance would cover, et cetera. But before we take this break, I want to ask one question. You mentioned that when we get the PFAS in us, it's about 3.5 years, is that what you said? No, or 3.5?
Yeah, it's years. It's the PFAS molecules, the C8s particularly, are 3 to 5 years in your bloodstream on average. Mm-hmm. So that if you had a triple exposure 12 years ago, you've now got 2.5 half-lives gone, which means you're at a quarter or an eighth of what you were originally, but in that range. And so that it circulates in the blood, unlike some other things that stick to the bone or stick to fatty tissue. Mm-hmm. These are basically bloodborne, which means they're carried to every organ. And the different PFASs are probably carried. We have a study out that shows that different PFASs go to different organs preferentially. So different ones go to the lungs, different one goes to the kidneys, different one goes to the brain. So the idea of replacing C8 with C6, that may really be a regrettable substitution if it no longer goes, doesn't make your liver explode, but the mice are showing much more activity in the brain with this stuff. And it's like, that's not what you want to see. And so these are it's a mouse, it doesn't count, but it's one of those things that you worry about this chemical that goes everywhere in the system. And the answer is that we all have it in our blood from background, just being North Americans, because it was used on Scotchgard, because it's used on Gore-Tex, because it's used on every possible commercial product we can think of, we're getting exposure. The things that the firefighters didn't know is that they're also getting it from their exposure, not just AFFF, but from the gear. And that's the nice part of being able to tell somebody, you know, you guys know how to handle risk. Just this is one more risk. And, you know, we're all going to die, but hopefully not soon. And the idea is to minimize risk and that'll reach that end. And what you guys are doing are talking about policy changes and provisions and stop gaps that will get you to the stage where you can have safer gear. And I think that's the mantra we're going to push, and not that you should worry about how it got to where it was, but more what's the step forward. What people don't feel hopeless as long as they see a way out. Mm-hmm. And as long as I can see this direction changing, then I think this is a pretty good solution. And yeah, we're driving market forces and we're being a pain in the butt to some people, but it's for the betterment of what the fire services need. And I think Diane's a wonderful inspiration that way. She is what I've described as a force of nature. She's not going to get out of the way of anybody. Right. And, good, more power to her. I wish more people were like that, honestly. Exactly. And, it brought my attention to something that I didn't know anything about. And so I make a contribution, but it's up to the fire services to decide what to do with it. And I think they're making wonderful progress. In a short period of time, it's gone from below the radar to, oh, we should talk about this and maybe we'll actually do something. And I think that's remarkable in 1 year.
Great. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, folks. When we come back, I have a couple more questions for my guest, Dr. Graham Peasley, professor at Notre Dame University in Indiana, probably one of the most prestigious schools in the country. And so we have a couple of questions to continue with, and we'll wrap this up. But we'll be right back right after these words. Please stay tuned. The tone sounds and the dispatcher announces, stations 14 and 16, working residential structure. And that was all you needed to hear. You jump up from your chair, head to the engine, and climb into the jump seat. As the cue screams, you take stock of your PPE. Bunker pants, check. Turnout coat, check. Hood, check. Gloves, check. Escape line, check. SCBA strapped on, you're ready. Upon arrival, you jump off the apparatus, grab the loops of the Red Cross lei, and head for the open front door, where smoke is pouring out. You make sure your buddy is behind you. Crouch low and make your way inside, your trusty SCBA mask hanging on your tool belt. What? Stop everything! What the hell are you thinking? You see, it's a working room and contents fire, and the smoke is banking down almost to the floor. Who do you think you are, Superman? One breath of that crap and the smoke will damage you in some way, guaranteed. All the soot, carbon, carcinogens, and other outgassing materials will enter your body through the pores on your unprotected face. Don't be the domino, the first person down, that forces everyone else to change their tasks to take care of you. Always remember, face piece on. You have comrades depending on you and a family to go to. Face peace on.
You show up for your shift, but you're not feeling 100%. You greet your colleagues with a smile, but just can't put your finger on it. I'll shake it off in an hour, you think to yourself. You take a couple of nothing runs, but you're still not feeling any better when you get back to the barn. You throw some cold water on your face and think, yeah, that's more like it. And you head back to the day room. With training scheduled for after lunch, you make yourself comfortable in one of the recliners, but as you sit there, you feel ill. You start to sweat, and you feel nauseous. There's a pain in your left arm that you've never had before. Hey guys, you call out. I'm not feeling well. And your voice trails, your eyes close, and the darkness surrounds you. More firefighters die from cardiovascular health issues than any other reason. Don't let self-pride get in the way of taking care of yourself. See your doctor on a regular basis, and be sure to advise him or her that you're a firefighter. Don't be a statistic. Be a healthy firefighter with a long career. For more information, visit the IAFF, NVFC, or IAFC SHS websites.
Well, you're ready to call it a night. The kids are tucked in, the lights are out, and the dog's in the den. Seems all is calm. But stop. It's not all right. To keep you and your family safe in the event of a fire, we're advising you to close before you doze. Close your bedroom doors when you go to sleep. Why? Because closed doors dramatically decrease heat and carbon monoxide levels, which provide trapped occupants more time for help to arrive and... Closed doors can slow the spread of the fire, increase oxygen levels, and decrease temperatures dramatically. You've invested in smoke and carbon monoxide alarms. You've practiced fire escape plans with your family. Now learn another important way to protect all of you. Close before you doze. Also remember, if you are able to escape, make sure the last one out closes the main door. Remember, close before you doze. This message is brought to you by the UL Firefighter Safety Research Institute, closebeforeyoudoze.org, your local fire department, and this podcaster. And welcome back to this episode of Five Alarm Task Force with my guest, Dr. Graham Peasley, Doctor of Nuclear Science at Notre Dame University. And we've been discussing the results of his studies for a couple of years now that he found an interest through a letter that our mutual friend, Diane Cotter, sent to him, an email, regarding her husband, Paul, a great firefighter from the great city of Worcester in Massachusetts, who after a promotion, shortly after a promotion, discovered he had cancer. How did it come so fast and so young? And that started the whole that was the little first snowflake, I guess we can call it. Mm-hmm. And it became this huge ball, just like in the cartoon that rolls down the hill. And thankfully it brought you in and it brought in Rob a lot. And so what I want to ask you, Dr. Beasley, is what brought you to, as a nuclear scientist, to come into the world of the fire service?
Very good. And I'm going to clarify, Steve, that I'm not the one who called Paul a snowflake. I'm going to let you take that credit. So, he's a wonderful man, and yeah. And he and his wife have done a real service to the fire.
I meant that they were the first snowflake that fell and started the ball rolling down the hill.
Explain that to Paul. That'll be great. Anyway, the answer is it's a long story, but I'll abbreviate. I have a basic I have a degree in chemical physics, and so I was in nuclear chemistry or nuclear physics, depending on which side of the fence you looked at, for many years, and did a lot of basic research onto how the nucleus works and how to study it with accelerators. And I discovered myself at an institution 20 years ago that had a position that was available if I could teach some environmental science. Sure, does it get me a job? Yes. Okay, I'll be happy. I've always wanted to teach environmental science. So I taught a little environmental science, but my research was always basic science and looking at fundamental effects of the nucleus and how radioactivity works and things like this. It's still quite an active field. And after doing that for a decade more, I began to realize that I should do something that's environmental. And I looked for local lakes that I could help clean up and understand why. It's just a feeling that I needed to contribute more to what I was doing other than just writing textbooks and articles that go into textbooks. And after several years of that, I met a woman from California who told me about this brominated flame retardant. And the fire services are well aware of that now because it was changed in just after I started working with her and started studying with my technique how to measure bromine in foams. The state of California changed the law on brominated flame retardants. And that was my first introduction to science affecting policy. It had been suggested years that this stuff shouldn't be used. It was ineffective and it was endocrine disruptor, awful endocrine disruptor. And yet, and it's what makes the smoke so toxic, or one of the reasons the smoke is so toxic to a firefighter. And so all the good reasons not to use this stuff. And I was happy to join the bandwagon, but it already happened before I got to it. And so I was interested in this shortly thereafter, my work on this looking at fluorine became much more successful than even my basic work, because it's nothing new. This fluorine gamma ray had been known for 30 years, but nobody had applied it to PFAS and said, oh, I could look for a common material and look for it. So that was my innovation. I said, oh, here's an old technique, and you know, there's six people in the world who've done it, and five of them are dead. So it's a pretty easy game. I said, what if we looked for this other, and it worked like a charm. So we worked with Jennifer Fields' lab in Oregon State and showed that it worked on textiles, it worked on paper. And we published a couple of papers that were very large in terms of the scientific community read them. And it wasn't my best work. I'd done all this work on the papers that only six people read. And suddenly the 23,000 people read this one. And it was like, oh, okay, it's just a question of being in the right spot at the right time. And I had a quick technique for looking for fluorine. And that's, but my burgeoning environmental interest was awakened, and Notre Dame hired me because of my ability to take physics and turn it into something that's applied. And the reason is that when you do basic science, you have to ask the government for funding, and you have to go back to them every year and ask for more and ask for more. And it's a very small discretionary part of the budget. It's 0.2%. So it's very little that goes into basic science in this country. Everything else is into Social Security, defense, and all the other big categories. But this is a minuscule amount. The National Science Foundation is terribly underfunded, but we got all money from it and was doing that. But to make it clear to the legislatures that you still wanted to fund science, what have you done for us recently? What have you made? Well, there's this thing called the internet. Heard of that? Oh, yeah. Okay. What else have you done? And so having a scientist who can take some of his work and spin it into societal applications was what I was hired for at Notre Dame. And I installed the new accelerator. I got it up and running. We started looking at fluorine everywhere. We also look at lead. We do lead poisoning in South Bend and now Indiana. We're doing a couple other features on flame retardants and toxic metals, micro antimicrobials. So we're looking at a lot of different areas. And then I get a letter from Diane. And it says, it's a heartfelt letter, a couple of pages long. And even then, from the one email, I was realized, I don't want to say no to this woman. She's going to run me over. And so I said, sure, I can measure it. And I didn't think anything more of it. And a month later, she'd sent me some materials from her husband's gear. And we ran them just to see what was there. And it was very high in fluorine. And that anytime you get a result that's so different from all of the other materials you look at it and say, wow, is all gear done this way? This is not where I'd put my PFAS. Why is it there? And I didn't know anything about turnout gear other than I've seen firefighters before. And I have, I have a distant cousin who was a fire chief when he was alive in Massachusetts, Hingham. But that was many, many years ago. And I'd met him, but it's distant. He's a sixth cousin or something. But it's one of those things that I was aware of the fire services and very supportive, but I didn't realize the cancer was as bad as it was. And studying what Diane sent me and then what I found on my own, and then starting to expand the study, saying we want to study it. And so it was a natural combination of my own environmental interests. I was interested firstly in the environment, but now, wait a second, there's an occupational exposure that's hitting in-service people. I don't have to wait till people are dead. Now I can work with somebody who's alive. And say, wow, I wonder if we could figure out what's going on here. And, you know, there was some feedback and some resistance, but I'm independent. I don't get funded by any company. I get, University of Notre Dame pays me to do my research, and I also get government funding I'm trying to sell this to the Department of Defense to say, here's a screening technique. And they funded me. I've got some DOE funding. I'm studying sports fish in the Great Lakes this month. So we're catching a bunch of fish and looking for PFAS in them. That's because the USGS is now, and NOAA are funding some studies to look at, do people eating fish get PFAS from our waste? And the answer is, yeah, not good. So it's everywhere. And we need a technique that's rapid so we can help there. But so my research continues, but the firefighters have been a big part of taking something that's very scientific and pretty dry into something that, well, it has a result that, boy, people should know about this. And everybody I spoke to didn't know it and said, are you sure that this is really PFAS and it's not some sort of other fluorine? Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's PFAS. We tested it and it is. And so, it can't be that bad. Not everybody has it. And I said, everybody's got it. So what do we do? And that led me to discuss lots of times. And there are several pioneers, and I'll call out Bobby Holt, and I'll call out some of these other people that actually had the guts to call me and give us a presentation. The manufacturers actually came and asked me, you know, what are you saying and why? And so I chatted with them and told them straight up what the paper's about and why I'm studying it and what I see and what is there. And they gave me some good feedback and said, yeah, well, okay, but it's not bad, right? And I said, well, no, I don't think it's so good. And so some of the manufacturers took it to heart, and it wasn't even from me, but they read social media and said, you know, do we have a plan B just in case? And that's how this whole thing got started. And I'm not interested in getting in the middle of lawsuits. I'm not interested in changing rules necessarily. It's a long time, and it'll Europe regulates everything in advance, and it'll take 8 years in Europe to change anything. I think it's a lot quicker if you simply say, hey, I've got an alternative that doesn't have the toxin in it. Wouldn't you like to buy that? And yeah, you know what? I bet you the market forces will work well in this case. It's what you're looking for are people that are standing in the way for no other reason other than, and the only company standing in the way is the one who makes the chemical. That's the one that really is going to lose. Nobody else is going to lose. They're all going to be leading the cause of, oh, this is fluorine free now. Great. I think the more we can make fluorine free in society, the less we'll have the drinking water issues that we're facing. I don't think that's the fire service's main issue, but it's certainly one of them. A lot of firefighters are not getting it from their gear, are not getting it from AFFF, are not getting it from combustion products. They're getting it from the water they drink, which they may have had a hand in helping put into the water system, because if you put out a fire with this foam, it's gotten into the water system, and that's the issue.
All right, so that brings up another question then. If it's in the water of a reservoir that the town or city draws its water from,
yep,
puts it through the reverse osmosis and all their filtering. And then many people like us have always had, well, since they came out, have always had the additional filter in the fridge. Mm-hmm. So our drinking water, cooking water is from the fridge, washing water and everything else is from the sink. Do these filters between the ones that the community uses for to process their water and the filter in the fridge for those who have it, can that help avoid any of that, or does that fluorine just kind of wiggle like a little eel and swims its way all the way through the filters as well?
And it's not actually swimming, but it does go through most filters. The reverse osmosis is different. Reverse osmosis will take it out. But that's a very expensive system, and there's no municipality in the world that uses that as a primary carrier, except for very expensive ones. You'll see, for example, in Michigan, there's a contamination outside Rockford, Michigan, which is the Wolverine Shoe Company that, accidentally lost all its disposal records for 30 years. And they dumped this stuff into its tannery waste, but had full of fluorinated chemicals. They made hush puppies, right? Waterproof shoes.
Sure.
And they put it into, they said, three unlined pits in people's yards that they bought from the farmer. It turned out to be they've got over 30 sites now that they've dumped this waste in. And it's under, the city grew and the farmers all sold the land. And so now they've got new developments putting down wells into this old farmer's field, which has got PFAS waste. So the highest recorded blood levels in North America are from a woman in Rockford, Michigan. Her husband's already dead, but she's got the up above, 1,300 parts per trillion in her blood or something like that at one point from drinking the water. And the reason I call out drinking water is because the your method of ingestion is, it's direct, and your body is a, very few things can take fluorine out of water. The humans are one of the best things to do it because your blood supply will actually filter the fluorine better. So that's a little sarcastic response I make sometimes, is that the best thing to do is have people drink it and you won't have it coming out anymore, because it really does go well into humans. It bioaccumulates in small animals, and then we eat small animals and the larger animals will get it better. So you can get it from food as well. Particularly wheat and grains take this stuff up, leafy vegetables. And so there are examples where people are being poisoned from the food they eat, which came from an AFFF. So is it AFFF? Yeah, it is. But it's coming a strange way. And I'm afraid firefighters are getting exposed that way too, because if they have a contamination in the backyard and it gets in the drinking water supply, not only they, but their whole township is now drinking it. And that's a source of concern. I think the gear is secondary to that. The gear probably won't poison everybody, but it could poison the user. We don't know how much hand-to-mouth transfer there is, and we don't know whether it goes through the skin. But I'll say this, before the study is published, all I'll say is that if I had to pick a chemical that I was going to wager on that would get through the skin is a pretty good barrier. It prevents most chemicals from going into the bloodstream, and that's the purpose of skin. But if I had to pick one, would you place a bet on the world's best surfactant we've ever made? Well, that would be one idea. I'd place a dollar on that. I'm going to bet some of this goes through. The question is how much, and maybe it's not much, but we'll have that study done in another year or 6 months, hopefully. And we should be able to have some quantitative numbers on that. I know that there are three other groups actively looking at that because it's been raised several times now. And so I think that we're looking at sources of exposure. We're looking at levels that get in, and that, you know, it can be very distressing. But I think we have phased out C8s in manufacturing in the U.S., so that's reducing their numbers in our blood. The C6s are going up still. And I think we can phase out non-essential uses. And there are a couple of essential uses that you're not going to be able to phase out, but AFFF isn't one of them. And that's already been shown. Mm-hmm. So now if you're going to send a spaceship to Pluto and back, it's going to need a lubricant that works in space for 30 years. That's going to be a fluorochemical, absolutely. There's a type of retinal eye surgery where you want to reattach a torn retina, right, and then to save the eyeball. That they use a perfluorinated compound to dose the eye up, so that it has to be just the right consistency. And there's a perfluoro liquid carbon liquid, perfluorocarbon liquid. So they use, but there's, and they're terrible PFASs. But if you're going to save eyesight, it's probably a pretty good essential use. There is no other chemical that works that well. Mm-hmm. But the scale is different. There's a 55-gallon drum made of this stuff every year. Okay, and that's all there is of this one chemical, and it's used for all the retinal eye surgeries in the world. If you look at PFOA, you've got, you know, tanker trucks per day being made of this stuff in China and being distributed, and that material once made will never go away. It's made forever, and you'll see it cycle through the bloodstream. It'll show up in polar bears. It'll show up in North Americans. It'll show up wherever the top predators are. It'll get into their blood because it was made once. So that's the environmental side of this that I think is so important, that we've got to stop making it. And if we reduce the number of places we use it, if you go up Mount Everest, yeah, you can have a waterproof jacket, and maybe it should be the best we've ever made. If you're putting out fire, you just need to stay dry, and silicones will work just fine. If you want to go to the mall, you know, does it need to be fluorinated at all? The best one, my students just discovered this. You'll like this. They're making waterproof swimsuits, which just boggles my mind. But you can now go from the swimming pool to the bar and not have to have a towel, and you're dry. That sounds like an essential use to me. And, you know, if you're going to use fluorochemicals to make that, then A, we're going to put more of the fluorochemicals, those swimsuits will go in the waste, and you will eventually drink the waste. And this way, this, and so the and long answer to your question is that the filters will not take it out. Typically, a Brita filter and things like that will not take out, especially the short chain PFAS. It will have some activated charcoal will take out long chain PFAS pretty well, but only for a limited time. And nobody measures it before and after anyway, so it's not a really good filter. The home filters, the ones that are reverse osmosis, will clean the water. And so that's what was delivered in Rockford, Michigan. Of course, it only handles 2 or 3 gallons an hour. The woman I spoke to said, yeah, I've got, is it going to work? I said, yes, change the filters every 6 months, you'll be good. And then she said, well, can I thank you? And then they'll send you $40. And I was like, no, I give advice for free. I don't really know how to get $40 in the door if I tried. So I thanked her and she said, well, can I send you a contaminated water supply? Well, that I'm interested in. I'm always interested in contaminated water because then you have a standard of what it is. But I said, you have reverse osmosis. Where are you going to get it from? Oh, I'll take it from the sprinkler system. I said, say what? they replaced this, but your taps are outside in West Michigan going tick, 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 tick with the water going across and there's no filter on that. No, because of course, it's a $5,000 unit to get even 2 or 3 gallons a minute, an hour out. Imagine trying to do a system that's 99% of your water use in agriculture or in lawn watering, which is what we do in West Michigan. It's too expensive. So we now have point sources of water that are hundreds, if not thousands of parts per trillion spraying through the backyards. And so I said, do you have a vegetable garden? She said, no. I said, good. Don't eat the grass. You're okay. But it's a good thing to know that we shouldn't be using watering systems in this same well.
Well, that's amazing because we have here at our home, we're the second owners of this house. We've been here since 92 and they dropped a well to use for the sprinkler system. Fresh water comes from the city, but they dropped the well there and it's rusty and I have to put a separate tank with a rust delimiter so it doesn't get on the side of the house and makes it.
Yeah, exactly. Things. We have the same thing here. Hard water.
Yeah. Hard water. Right. But I never thought of it in that same way. Was PFAS one of the key elements in the Flint water disaster?
It wasn't. That was all lead. It was a criminal act. They changed the lead softening, additive they added to the water. They just saved money and said, nah, people won't notice. We'll just turn it off. And it was not a scientist who made that discovery, nor even a water manager. The water managers knew better than do that. Mm-hmm. But they just did it anyway. And of course, the people who went to jail were not that guy. He fled down, went to Florida, I think. Somebody went to jail for that, and that's because people's lives were put in danger by this. PFAS is much more insidious. Nobody knows it's there. It's really hard to measure, and when we do measure it, it's everywhere. So what's a little bit over a long time versus a lot right now? Well, obviously, you want to avoid the a lot right now, but drinking waters is one of the the limits we're getting are very low in the part per trillion of the measurements, because if you drink several cups of this a day, you'll find that it doesn't take much before you start having effects in the humans that you can see.
Wow, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, I know you have to run, and I just want to, again, thank you so much for being a guest. Mm-hmm. More importantly, for taking on this amazing task, the work that you did. You know, a lot of scientists work for certain things and they turn the information over to their bosses and nobody really hears about it. But you did something that reached out to 1.2 million firefighters in this country, both career, volunteer, part paid, and their families. And their communities too. And there is no way to truly, truly thank you for what you've done for us. And it's an honor really to have you join me again.
Well, thank you, Steve.
It's information.
Very nice to say that. I'd like to tell you and your listeners that, you know, the reason we do this is for the firefighter. I mean, thank you for your service. And that doesn't get said enough these days. So I always try to say that at the end of my talks, just remind myself why I'm doing this. It's not just for the textbooks, but there are people out there and they're risking their lives for us. This is a small contribution. We hope it helps.
It will. There's no doubt about it. Dr. Beasley, once again, thank you very much. I hope we'll be in touch with them sometime in the next year and hear the continuation of your PFAS story.
Oh, I'm sure there'll be more papers. I'm not invited to many parties twice, so it's kind of fun to get invited back. So
that's great. Again, thank you.
Don't eat the popcorn. Yeah.
Especially if it has that fake butter on it.
Yeah, that's fine.
But thank you very much. Stay safe and stay well, and much continued success in all your.
Thank you, Steve. Much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Stay safe.
You're listening to Five Alarm Task Force.
Cancer. We know what it has done to our fire service, but we can fight back. Timely and continual medical screenings are essential at helping prevent and treat fire service-related cancers. Here are some available resources. The NFPA 1582 standard on a comprehensive occupational medical program for fire departments. This standard outlines an occupational medical program that will reduce risks and provide for the health, safety, and effectiveness of firefighters operating to protect civilian life and property. Here's another one, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, the FCSN. Since 2005, this nonprofit has provided assistance and one-on-one mentoring to thousands of cancer-stricken firefighters and their families. FCSN also delivers extensive firefighter cancer awareness and prevention training nationwide. If you would like more information from the IAFC, the FCSN, and additional information from Dr. Michael Hamrock, including a copy of a letter you can present to your personal doctor, please visit the IAFC company resource page, all in lowercase letters, tiny.ty.cc/F as in Frank, H hotel, 0, A apple, Q queen, Z zebra. Again, all in lowercase, that's tiny.cc/F Frank, H hotel, 0, A apple, Q queen, Z zebra. You'll find this and more information on cancer prevention there. Remember, the Firefighter Cancer Initiative was created to keep you safe and healthy.
Psst. Yeah, you. It's me, your heart. Listen to me. We've got to talk. High blood pressure is serious, and yours? Whoa. What happened to us? We used to be so much more active. But lately, you've been ignoring me. I know you think I'm just gonna keep ticking away forever, but you're wrong. You can do so much more to control your high blood pressure. Doing the minimum isn't doing enough. I'm under a lot of pressure and can quit whenever I want. Bet you didn't know that. But I like my job. Just treat me better. Check on me. Give me something green to nibble on every once in a while. And maybe we can do some exercise on occasion. Let's get to it. After all, we're in this together.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. Check, change, control. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Steve. Well, we're getting closer and closer to the big announcement. I think we might have about 2 to 3 weeks to go before we launch the corporation, the new website, etc., and we'll be able to accept donations. There'll be a PayPal button on pages of the website, and you can use any method of payment that you want that PayPal accepts. And that will come directly to our foundation fund. That's the way we've set it up. As some of you may know, we also set up a separate account called our operations account. And that's what helps pay the bills for the internet, for equipment, etc. And no, we're not going crazy with new equipment, but we have to function. And that's the operations account. And we didn't want to mix them because we want to have an exact reckoning of both those accounts because it's your money, the money that our listeners or businesses will donate to us. And you have the right to know exactly where that money went. So if you will decide you'd rather, well, I want to help the operations too, let them function, well, you'll be able to do that too in a different manner. But you'll be able to help us. And that's the goal. Why are we asking you for help? For one reason only. It's not
just for this podcast. Truly, this is about us helping firefighters and other first responders in dire need. I'm not sure if you heard the news just last week, but a firefighter, I believe in Northern California, fighting one of the big fires up there, while he was out there on that terrible forested fire ground, burning all around him, he lost his wife and children in a fire in their manufactured home back where they lived. Terrible tragedy. And that's something that we would reach out to. I don't need to vet that story. It's been covered. We know, the three of us who will make the decisions here, that that's a worthy cause. God forbid it should never happen again. But that's something that we would do. We don't have thousands of dollars to give, but we have some money we'll be able to give, we hope. Just a little bit counts to let that person reestablish themselves, find a place to stay of their own, etc. That's what we're about. That's what Five Alum Task Force Corp is going to be about, helping other people. That's our focus. Giving you great podcasts and helping you in ways that we never could before, we hope. But it all depends what comes in. And another way I want to help you is that Five Alum Task Force, with all the effort and time I've put in, and I really love doing this as we've entered our fifth season, is not the only firefighting, fire-themed podcast out there. And I'd like to tell you about several others that I listen to on a fairly regular basis. The first is Can Man Radio Show with my good friend, Lieutenant Jason Liska. Jason was on episode 5.2, 5-2, just last week. And we've gotten some great responses regarding that. The Professional Volunteer with Chief Brian Soller. Flow and Vent. BAR, Brotherhood Academy Radio with Nick Hilton and his crew. DTFF, Down to Fight Fire. Some volunteers over in British Columbia, Canada, have a great podcast. SA Matters, Situational Awareness Matters with Dr. Rich Gassaway, an amazing podcast. Definitely you need to tune into that. Jump Seat Radio, Captain Ryan Pennington. Ryan's been our guest several times. Great information, especially if it deals with hoarding, when you respond to a home or any location where you know there's hoarding going on. Pin the Cue. Code 3, Do Work. The Thin Red Line with another good friend, Captain John Haywick. The Fire Rescue Show, Average Jake Firefighter. And Robbie's been with us a couple of times as well. A great podcast. And Fit to Fight Fire. So all of these are here for you to listen to learn from, to enjoy, however you want to look at it. But that's what we're here to do, to help you, educate you, entertain you, and provide information that will make you a better firefighter or other first responder. So stay safe and stay well. And you know the tagline, that's my view.
Did you know that 90% of American communities are served by volunteer fire departments? And that many of those departments are actively looking for more volunteers. When you hear those sirens, do you say to yourself, wish I could do that? If you have the drive to serve, you can be a volunteer too. Volunteer and combo departments are always looking for new recruits. You'll be trained in the latest firefighting and rescue techniques and protecting your community at the same time. You will be joining the ranks of over 1 million men and women who serve their cities and towns, protecting lives and property. Did you know that the founder of the first volunteer fire department was Benjamin Franklin? If old Ben can do it, so can you. Drop by your local fire department and introduce yourself. You just might know some of the folks already there. Before you know it, those volunteers will be like family. Anyone can be a volunteer. Sure, it takes time and effort, but in your heart, you'll realize that it's all worth it. Want more information? Contact your local fire department or visit makemeafirefighter.org. Alternate. Did you know that 7 out of 10 firefighters in the U.S. are volunteers? And the number of volunteer firefighters is declining every year. Most American fire companies are working to recruit new members. When you hear those sirens, do you say to yourself, "Wish I could do that"? If you have the drive to serve, you can be a volunteer too. Volunteer fire departments are always looking for new recruits. You'll be trained in the latest firefighting and rescue techniques, as well as emergency medical services to protect your community. Volunteers are also needed to help with fundraisers, conduct fire safety programs, and pitch in around the fire station. Drop by your local fire department and introduce yourself. You just might know some of the folks already there. Before you know it, those volunteers will be like family. Anyone can be a volunteer. Sure, it takes time and effort, but in your heart, you'll realize that it's all worth it. Want more information? Contact your local fire department or visit makemeafirefighter.org. Presented by the National Volunteer Fire Council and 5 Alarm Task Force.
And that wraps this episode of 5 Alarm Task Force, brought to you by 5 Alarm Task Force Corp. One family, one mission, first responders helping each other. We would like to thank our guest, Dr. Graham Peasley, who joined us to discuss fluorinated products in our bunker gear and their impact both on us and on our environment. Did you know you can find us and subscribe to us on all the top podcast platforms? Just search for 5 Alarm Task Force. We also want to thank our sponsors, Insight Training LLC and the Firehouse Tribune, as well as our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, LifeScan Wellness Centers, Nesta Bars, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, the Albemarle Sweet Shop, the North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. If you would like to be a guest with us or have a suggestion for a show, please drop us a line at nowmattprod@outlook.com. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at 5 Alarm Task Force, on Facebook at /DowMattProdFire, and on YouTube we hope you'll subscribe to our new channel, 5-Alarm Task Force Corp. Stay up to date with all the news about our podcast, our new nonprofit foundation, and our blog on our website, www.dalmatianproductions.tv. And that address is going to change in the not-too-distant future. I'm Steve Green. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and let's make sure everyone goes home.